Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents All the Pretty Shoes by Marika Roth, narrated by Ellen Dubin. Chapter 1. Massacre in Budapest. I will never forget that cold winter afternoon on January 8, 1945. When I watched hundreds of Jews in the Swedish protected housing complex rounded up by the Arrow Cross Execution Brigade and dragged away, regardless of their age or gender, to the banks of the Danube. I was barely 13 years old. I had moved into the Swedish protected housing shortly after my escape from the roundup of hundreds of Jews in a park near the yellow star-tagged housing from where my father was taken. One morning, without warning, the Germans had busted into our courtyard, rounded up all the men from the building, shoved them into trucks with bayonets pointed at their backs, then hauled them off to an unknown destination. As my mother was dead, and I had no other family to turn to, once my father was taken from me, I was left to fend for myself. I became a lone fugitive, forever on the lookout for a place to hide without being detected or killed. In some ways, being a child was in my favor, for it made it relatively easy for me to melt into places where I did not belong. In the chaos we lived under, everyone thought I belonged to someone else. So it was that while others had to pay a large sum of money to live in the Swedish protection housing, I was able to slip in unnoticed and stay for free, my very presence making people believe that I had a right to be there. There were hundreds of people from the upper class who had given up their life's savings to buy into the Swedish protection program. To them, it was like investing in their lives, for after all, they were made to believe that they would be safe and protected under Swedish law from Nazi persecution. Because there were a limited number of these houses, they soon became terribly overcrowded. To make room for all these desperate people hanging on to their lives, all the furniture in the apartments was taken out and put into piles in the downstairs courtyard. Soon we found ourselves huddled together like penguins, men, women, and children of all ages who together shared a common goal: to try to keep warm, fight off hunger, and stay alive. Yet for all our efforts to keep ourselves from freezing, it was clear we needed some added heat, especially since young and old all slept next to each other on bare floors. Finally, a collective decision was made by the family heads to sacrifice their cherished expensive furniture. It was chopped up and thrown into the fire, because at the end of the day, all that mattered to us was to stay warm. The fact that we were harbored under the Swedish protected housing system gave us some degree of security. We lived under the assumption of safety, which in turn gave us courage and some modicum of hope for the future. On the evening, before my story begins, I don't think any of us, as we sat by the fire trying to keep ourselves warm, suspected the horrific fate that was awaiting us. It happened late afternoon when, without the slightest warning, as was the fascists' usual modus operandi, the Nazis and the Arrow Cross Army, comprised of Hungarian Nazi sympathizers who for the most part were more merciless than the Germans themselves, invaded our housing complex. Judging from their commands, it didn't take long for any of us to realize that the Germans had broken their treaty with the Swedish government. In their eagerness to kill as many Jews as they could find, large groups of soldiers barged into our four-story apartment building and forced all the tenants to step out onto the communal balcony with hands held high. Pointing their rifles in our direction, the soldiers stood at attention, waiting for their leader's command. Then at the sound of the word, "Auf Euren," The soldiers obediently aimed their machine guns and sprayed their bullets into the helpless victims who stood humbly awaiting their inevitable death. As soon as I heard the first shot, I let myself fall to the ground. Still, I was able to see and to hear people's cries. Dozens of victims folded like paper dolls. Their lifeless bodies fell one by one and piled on top of each other in a pool of blood, while I lay motionless, feigning my death. I shut my eyes and tried to block off the sound of gunshots by pretending that I was someplace else. After all that had happened to me, I was an expert at being able to shut out reality by turning to happy memories and by fantasizing. On this particular occasion, I thought of a movie my father once took me to see. It was an American movie called Sun Valley Serenade, in which Sonia Henie skated on ice in a lovely, shiny costume. The pine trees around her were all lit up like Christmas trees, making the scene magical. I promised myself that I would not rest until one day I could immigrate to America, just like Sonia Henie. But soon, I was awakened from my daydream by a harsh kick to my rib cage. Knowing full well that my life hung in the balance, I forced myself to remain limp and motionless without showing my pain. The soldier who had kicked me with his boot was easily satisfied by my lifeless appearance, and since there were so many other bodies he needed to inspect, he quickly moved on. I lay still in the same spot without moving a muscle long after darkness set in. In a strange way, I felt safe lying there, assuming that since everyone was dead, the soldiers would not return. But after a while, that eerie silence became unbearable, and I was eager to move on. It was clear that I was the only survivor. Wasting no time, I rose from the dead, climbed over their bodies, ran down the stairs from the second floor, then slipped into the dark street with the stealth of an accomplished burglar. Realizing that apartment buildings were unsafe, this time I was headed toward a nearby park alongside the Danube, where I remembered Mother would often take me to listen to Sunday concerts of Johann Strauss music when I was a toddler. Being familiar with the park, I knew it had many bushes, so I was confident that I could find a safe hiding place. I selected a bush at the very edge of the park, closest to the Danube, and brushed away my footprints in the snow. Then, camouflaged by the branches, curled up like a cat and settled in for the night, trying to keep warm and nursing my sore side from the soldier's kick. I thought about what had happened earlier in the day, and I congratulated myself, knowing how proud my parents would have been of me for my bravery and my cleverness. I thought about my mother and how she couldn't possibly have survived this terrible war. For the first time since I lost her, I was actually glad that she was no longer alive. It was comforting to know that she, at least, did not have to be exposed to humiliation and torture. She had been so fragile, so delicate. It also felt reassuring to remember some of the tender moments Mother and I shared together during our better days before she became ill with tuberculosis. I recalled the times the two of us walked arm in arm along the fashionable avenues, looking at all the pretty shoes and dresses in shop windows. Mother was opposed to buying ready-made clothes or shoes. To her, it was just as inconceivable as wearing fake jewelry. People of class only wore real jewelry and tailor-made shoes and clothes. Accordingly, all my clothes and shoes had to be handmade, to which I objected heartily since I resented having to stand for what I considered to be hours for proper fittings. I cherished the times Mother confided in me that I was her best friend, for I admired her beauty, her slim figure, and her elegant manner, all of which made me feel proud that she was my mother and my friend. Compared to other children whose mothers were so ordinary, I felt like the luckiest child on the planet. At times, I wondered if I could or would ever take after her when I grew up. Then there were the times when Mother and I would stroll along the banks of the Danube, not far from where I was hiding, and listen to gypsies play their tambourines and violins, sending out their young children to solicit money from the people listening. Their costumes always fascinated me, with their layers of multicolored skirts ornamented with lots of fake jewelry. There was never a time when Mother did not turn men's heads as we passed by. In this very park was where, in my younger years, I used to chase pigeons. Mother would say, "You can only catch them if you throw salt on their tails." I recalled her delightful laughter as she playfully teased me with the prospect. My thoughts turned to my father. I wondered how far the Germans had taken him from me, and if he were still somewhere in Budapest. I worried about the Germans hurting him and about how we would find each other again once all this madness was over. We should have made plans, but then again, we were never even given a chance to say goodbye to each other. He was taken away so quickly. I decided that we would simply return to the house from where he was taken, which to me made perfect sense. Finally, comforted by this thought, I found my eyes closing from exhaustion. I must have dozed off, because the next thing I heard were harsh commands both in German and in Hungarian, followed by the familiar sound of machine guns. It was freezing cold that foggy dawn near the Danube, but my fear of being discovered kept me perfectly still. As I peeked through the bushes, I witnessed a horrendous sight. A long row of Jews, men, women, and children, was lined up along the edge of the river. While I could not see their faces, I could see their shoes well enough to recognize that these were shoes of good quality belonging to the members of an affluent society. Yet, regardless of their stature, there they stood, humbled and humiliated in the last moments of their lives. I could hear their loud, agonizing cries as they begged for their lives. But their pleading fell on deaf ears, and before long, the soldiers of the Hungarian Arrow Cross aimed their rifles and shot them point blank. Hundreds of limp bodies fell straight into the cold waters of the Danube. My heart ached for those victims, even as I held my breath for fear of being discovered. Suddenly, I found myself thinking, do I even want to live in this kind of misery? How long can this war last? Isn't there anyone out there who can save us? From my vantage point, I could both see and hear some of the lifeless bodies fall into the river, tinting the blue Danube deep red with the endless flow of their Jewish blood. I covered my eyes. I couldn't understand the reason for all the hatred that was so suddenly directed at us. What was so terrible about being Jewish? How were we different from anyone else? What could the Jews have done to deserve such cruel execution? I suddenly hated myself for who I was. For a brief moment, I became my own Nazi, wishing I had been born someone else. I was living in this terrible nightmare, all the while hoping that I would soon awake in the arms of my parents and all my misery would be over. But there was no time to reflect on my feelings. I knew that if I wanted to stay alive to see my father again, I had to remain focused on my survival, to find a way out of this hell and move on. Realizing that my chances of escaping death in the city were practically nil, I decided to head for the outskirts of Budapest, where I assumed Jews were less likely to be persecuted, since they were far fewer in number. Once again, I waited till sunset. Then I took off on foot toward my grandfather's house in the outskirts of Budapest, in a town called Angel's Pasture. While I walked on my lengthy journey, I reflected once again on my narrow escape from death and began to believe that perhaps my mother or some sort of unknown forces were protecting me. How else could I have managed over and over again to survive? I began to wonder who I was. How and why did I get here? Chapter 2. From the Beginning. Budapest, Hungary, 1912. The year my mother was born was still part of that romantic era when men courted women with flowers and gifts, and young ladies were still chaperoned to dances. Women wore pretty lace dresses and bows in their hair, and they conducted themselves with refined elegance. This was a city that provided the finer things in life: the opera, the ballet, and the free park concerts. The number one song was Alexander's Ragtime Band, and the Charleston was the craze. The monarchy was still in power, and the class system was still very much entrenched. Long considered one of the most beautiful cities in Europe, Budapest offered many elegant cafes with outside terraces, marvelous promenades lined with fine old trees, and welcoming shade with sequestered areas where lovers could steal an occasional kiss. Seven bridges crossed the Danube from Pest, the city, to Buda, the mountainside. One bridge led to the long and narrow Margaret Island, with its large hotel, coffee houses, traditional Turkish baths where one could get a fabulous massage, its warm sulfur springs, restaurants, and public swimming pools. Margaret Island was like an escape to paradise. Not unlike Paris, Budapest was a place for lovers. Legend had it that at one of the fashionable cafes, a young engineer once approached a woman, unaware she was married, and asked her for a date, whereupon the husband, hearing of the incident, challenged the young man to a duel and shot him dead on the spot with a single bullet. Had such been the practice in my grandmother's social circle, she would have likely caused the death of numerous young men in their pursuit of her favor, since grandmother was a huge flirt. It was well known that her weakness was men, and her love for them was not curtailed, even following her marriage to my grandfather. Mother was born in the month of December, just a couple of weeks short of Christmas. The day was cold, not just because of the season, but because her arrival was unwelcome. She was the fourth child, and only her brother and sisters gathered around her crib, happy to celebrate the new addition to the family. My grandmother wanted nothing to do with this baby who had arrived in the midst of her pursuit of a divorce from my grandfather. As the years passed and mother grew into her teens, grandmother never missed a chance to tell her that she was unwanted, that she had been nothing more than an accident. At times, she even teased mother by telling her she was adopted. So lacking in parental love was she that at the age of 15, mother swallowed a handful of pills, intending to end her miserable life. Instead of showing regret and compassion, her angry parents scolded her severely and blamed each other for their daughter's suicide attempt. This incident caused a family uproar, and ultimately, my grandfather packed his bags and moved out, even though their divorce had not been finalized. To this day, I don't know if it ever even was. Since there was not much money in the family, grandfather moved with his 90-year-old father to a suburb called Angel's Pasture, a small working-class district outside of Budapest where less expensive housing was to be had. Grandmother, on the other hand, already had her new man lined up, and it wasn't long before she shacked up with him. Following the family breakup, grandmother's only son, George, moved from Hungary to France, where he eventually settled down and married a French woman. Grandmother's first child, Ella, died at an early age of cancer of the larynx, leaving grandmother with two of her four children nearby, my mother and her middle daughter, Clary, her favorite. Living with a dysfunctional family was not easy for my mother, who was sensitive and kind by nature. Being continually abused by her mother, even after her failed suicide, still caused her to question herself whether she wanted to live or die. As a means of escaping her misery, she made it her business to get out of the house, away from her mother, and socialize in cafes. It was on one of these occasions whereupon she met my father. Father was so consumed by gambling that he was still a bachelor as he was nearing 40. He had never thought much about getting seriously involved with women, since gambling was not just his profession, but also his passion. Yet, as soon as he saw my mother, he was so smitten by her beauty and charm that he was prepared to sacrifice all and change his life forever. Mother was 17 when she blissfully accepted my father's proposal of marriage. Father saw her as a young, vivacious, exciting young woman full of ambition, hardly realizing that she was at the end of her recovery period from attempted suicide. When Father arrived in her life, she saw him as her knight in shining armor. This was her prince who, with his proposal of marriage, instantly liberated her from her wretched family life. Because of my father's reputation as a gambler and the fact that he was 23 years older than my mother, both sides of the family disapproved of their relationship. Although no one seemed to have cared about them before, now suddenly everyone had a say in how this apparently loving young couple should manage their lives. But my parents ignored their warnings, and in December, shortly after Mother's 17th birthday, they took their marriage vows. It was a small civil ceremony attended only by the necessary witnesses. Father, who was exceptionally gifted in his trade, did well most of the time. As a result, the newlyweds happily settled into a lovely apartment in an upscale Budapest neighborhood. Mother quickly became accustomed to the finer things in life and even hired a German nanny, this being the practice in elite circles, 1 year after I was born. By the time I was able to form sentences, I was fluently bilingual in Hungarian and German. To the best of my knowledge, my parents enjoyed their marital bliss for only a short period. My father worshipped my mother, and she adored her comfortable lifestyle. But as with all addictions, even with the best of intentions, promises are broken. Following their brief honeymoon, Father gradually began to fall back into his old profession, since he was not much good at anything else. Within a year after my arrival, it became clear that this marriage had not been made in heaven. Unlike Father, Mother had ambitions to ascend socially. She hated what she considered the bourgeois gambling sphere in which Father moved. While his life revolved around horses, coffee houses, and casinos, her passion was all about elegance, culture, and refinement. Fortunately for her, her looks and charm allowed her a natural entree into high society, where she was at her best, mingling with influential people. Mother in her 20s was in love, not with my father, but with the intellectual stimulation of the arts, theater, opera, museums, high fashion, and the overall atmosphere of the elite. Though Father must have known this about Mother before he married her, he was much too intoxicated by her charm and beauty to pay attention to the warning signs. It had to have been apparent that his proposal of marriage was just a convenient ticket out for Mother, an escape from her miserable existence. But being the gambler that he was, he took a chance, perhaps naively believing that in time she would learn to love him and accept him for who and what he was. A year following their nuptials, the joy that came with my birth temporarily numbed and distracted them from their brewing conflict. In spite of their failing marriage, they were both excellent parents. Father was a gentle soul, loving and caring, and as far as I was concerned, his gambling for me was a benefit. Although he was seldom home to tuck me into bed at night, he never forgot to leave me part of his winnings on the night table with a note that read, "I love you." He adored me, and was never hesitant to let me know. Oftentimes, he would sing me his favorite Hungarian ballad.
There's one little girl in the world, and she is my darling turtle dove. God must have loved me very much for giving her to me.
From my youthful perspective, both my parents loved me equally. I was the focus of their attention. As if to compensate for her unhappy childhood, Mother gave me the depth of love she never received as a child. I returned her affection in kind by being obedient. She would read me fairy tales every night at bedtime, some of which she had written herself. With her beautiful stories about princesses who lived in magnificent castles, she was able to both entertain and subtly educate me as to her expectations for me. Each of my parents let me know how important I was to them, and that made me feel very special. Without realizing it at the time, I was the catalyst that held their marriage together, at least until I was 5. It was their consistent love and devotion for me during those years that later gave me the tools to survive, and that sustained me throughout the rest of my life. When I was 6, I became terribly sick with diphtheria. As my condition weakened to the point where I could no longer walk or get out of bed, the doctor suggested that I be taken to a higher altitude to strengthen my overall condition. Mother immediately took measures to move me to the mountains, where we checked into a 4-star hotel that was located right at the foot of a magnificent mountain. There I was bedridden for some time, until at length I was able to walk to the window, where I spent my time enviously watching children of the other guests play in the garden. There were many crows in the garden, and Mother would tell me stories about how crows liked to steal gold and shiny objects, which is why many of them lived in palaces. Mother's wonderful stories kept me entertained for a while, until finally I became strong enough to join the other children in the garden. On one of these occasions, while my friends and I were playing hide and seek, one kid suggested that we climb over the 4-foot brick wall that was separating the garden from the vast mountain, just to see what lay ahead. Without further ado, everyone started to climb, their strong, healthy legs carrying them far into the distance, while I, in my weakness, straggled behind. It was then that suddenly a young man appeared from nowhere and said, "Would you like me to help you catch up to your friends?" Without waiting for my reply, the young man took my hand and began dragging me toward the bushes in the opposite direction. As soon as I felt his strong grip, I sensed that I was in danger. I tried to free myself, but it was too late. He threw me on the ground and started ripping off my pants. As weak as I was, I fought back with all my might, and while kicking and scratching, I must have accidentally kicked him in the groin, for all at once he let go of me, giving me an opportunity to get up and run. How I made it back to the hotel with no more than scratches is still a miracle. All I know is that someone who saw my pitiful condition called for my mother, who appeared in a flash, rushed me upstairs to our room, called a doctor, put me in a hot bath, and notified the police. Following this incident, Mother sat me down and took it upon herself to educate me about the birds and the bees, and about how women and men were different, and that private parts were to remain very secret from strangers' hands. From 1932 to 1935, a political power struggle was waged in Hungary between the liberal conservatives and the radicals of the far right. In 1935, the far right gained the upper hand, and this was to have a profound and disastrous effect upon the Hungarian Jewish community. This was also the period when my parents finally separated and then divorced, causing my personal paradise to crumble. Mother wanted exclusive custody so she could keep me at a safe distance from father's gambling and his casino lifestyle. I instantly became the prize in a raging contest being fought in the name of parental love.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?